I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. It's been a strange week. Not quite sure why, but because I've spent it going back over the case we're doing, it's been rather gloomy. And it's a very, very big case, which we're going to do in two episodes. And I've found it kind of curiously upsetting.
I'm sorry.
No.
Put you through the ringer.
It's just such a... It's a famous case and it's a very dramatic case, but there is something about the individual concerned and indeed the victims that moves me deeply. Plus, it is also a severely botched police operation.
Well, hold fire, because... Yeah.
Let's talk about something cheerful for a bit.
Well, we need to make a big Patreon, and it's not a specific... It's like a big... We're doing a thing.
Okay.
We're doing a thing.
What are we doing?
Okay, so what we're going to do is, as part of our kind of what you get if you're on our Patreon and join our Patreon.
Okay.
No obligation, listeners, to join or not join. Everyone who supports us, thank you so much. You all support us just by listening.
Absolutely.
If you also would like to support us through Patreon, we'd be thrilled, but no obligation.
No, no.
Anyway, if you do and you're in the top, there's like three different tiers you can join for different levels of, you pay different amounts of money and you get different stuff.
Okay.
Anyway, what we're going to do is we're going to do a little competition. It's not really a competition. What we would like everybody to do is write in within a topic. I'm not explaining this hugely well. Basically, we're going to get you all to write in ideas of cases that Geoffrey can do.
Okay.
And then the people on our top tier of our Patreon are going to choose which one they would like Geoffrey to do. And that is going to be our Christmas ep, our final ep before Christmas. And we are going to film us recording it. I'm going to make Geoffrey wear a Santa hat and drink eggnog while he's doing it.
I hate
eggnog.
He's
shaking his head. He would never do either of those things. I will wear a Santa hat and drink eggnog, and I'll get drunk. And
where does this eggnog come from?
Isn't it Christmassy eggnog?
I don't think so.
I don't really like mulled wine.
No, I don't like mulled wine.
I like mulled cider.
No, I've never tried that.
Betsy will wear a Christmas outfit. It will be very jolly. Anyway, that means that we're going to tell you the theme that we would like to do is famous people who have committed crime or been murdered. So in honor of that, in the next, not after these two upcoming episodes, we are going to do an episode on Oscar Pistorius, and then we're going to do an episode on Fatty Arbuckle.
Yeah.
Both of whom are famous people who were accused of murder.
Yes.
And so we would like it very much if any of you, any listener, could write in on a case of a famous person who's either been murdered or committed murder.
And they can contact us how, Mo?
All of the ways. You can put your ideas through Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, our email, which is bloodties.podcast@gmail.com. And you need to have submitted it by the 4th of December.
Okay.
And the voting will take place on the Patreon between the 7th and 11th of
Fine.
December. And the winner's episode will air on the 21st of December.
Fine.
And as I've said, it will be filmed. And if you're on our Patreon, you'll be able to see the video of it as well.
Well, there you go. Sounds good.
I hope I explained that clearly.
Yes.
I will explain it again at the beginning of the next episode. And hopefully I'll do that more succinctly.
No, it's fine.
Yeah, so we thought that would be a jolly thing to do. That will be our last Christmas step. So after we've got through this of this difficult case for Dad, hopefully the last three will be a bit... No, the Pistorius case is awful, but
I have watched every minute.
It's so long, that documentary.
It goes on forever.
It's like 7 hours.
I almost lost the will to live.
I know. There's a new Pistorius documentary on BBC on Storyville, which is one of the reasons we're going to cover it. A couple of you have written in about it. And I started with first episode's 90 minutes, the second episode's 70.
Oh, the last one's 110.
What?
Yeah.
How is there even that much?
I watched it twice.
You watched it twice?
Yes. Anyway. I think I was trying to convince myself it really was that long. Maybe 108. It went on and on and on and on. But it was very illuminating, and they had some terrific witnesses, particularly the former girlfriend. Who was very telling.
I'm going to finish it, obviously, before we do it. But anyway, we digress. So basically, that is what is coming up, and that will lead us up until the end of the year. We were going to take a break now, but we've decided not to. We're just going to carry on, especially because we are doing the Yorkshire Ripper this week and next week, because he just died. So it felt prevalent.
Yes, it did. And we've also, as ever, thank you so much for writing to us. We had correspondence this week from one of our most faithful and devoted listeners, Phil Brown.
Hey, Phil.
Who's been listening, believe it or not, to every episode back to back, because he's not been sleeping well.
I love that people listen to us at night time. It was like, can't wait for Monday night so I can drift off to sleep. You're like, what?
Right.
Right, so let's get going. So this is The Yorkshire Ripper Part 1.
Peter William Sutcliffe was born on the 2nd of June 1946 in Bingley, West Yorkshire. He was, to put it politely, a weak baby. He was very small. He was only weighed 5 pounds.
That is small.
When he was born. And he was really quite peely-wally, as we would say in Scotland. He wasn't very fit. He was pale complexion, really thin. He was raised by John and Kathleen, his parents, who were good Catholics. And he was raised a Catholic. But he was, as we say so often in these cases, somehow slightly remote from everybody. He had brothers and sisters, but he was mollycoddled by his mother, who'd lost a son shortly after birth earlier. And I think she focused a lot of attention on Peter. And it's very interesting that after his conviction and in prison and then in Broadmoor, Sutcliffe reverted to his mother's maiden name, Coonan. He called himself Peter Coonan. He was known as Peter Coonan, not as Peter Sutcliffe. Sutcliffe was smart, but not clever. He left school at 15. He got all sorts of odd jobs, but the most famous of which was as a grave digger, which he seemed to quite enjoy. And there are many stories associated with Sutcliffe. I think it was 18-year-old Sutcliffe digging graves and saying at one point, and indeed it's in his confession, I dug out his statement to the police when he was finally caught, saying that he was inspired by having, hearing voices while he was digging a grave. He was a remote sort of man. I would say that would be fair. Didn't really have much in the way of social graces. But he did in 1967, on Valentine's Day, 1967, when he was 21, well, just before his 21st birthday, to be accurate, he came across a 16-year-old girl called Sonia Zurma, S-Z-U-R-M-A, who was only 16 and whom he found fascinating. He was a good bit older, but never mind, only 4 years. And I think she was the first person whom he felt that he could talk to, the first girl he felt he could talk to. And in many ways, he became devoted to her. Sonia was not originally, was born in this country, but her parents weren't. And there is something about this young man that is striking. He had very, very piercing brown eyes. He was very neat, had a goatee beard. Everybody remembers the photo fits of him with the goatee and beard and a moustache. He had a very high, squeaky voice with a Bradford...
Like me.
No, I think yours is... His was even squeakier.
Squeakier than mine?
Yes. He had a Bradford accent, not thick, but nevertheless Yorkshire accent. And he had a rather shy manner. Well, nothing could have prepared you for what was to emerge in Peter Sutcliffe's life. Like so many, and we've talked about this, Mo, haven't we, many times, serial killers, and certainly Sutcliffe deserves the title of being a serial killer, often start out with petty crime. And in his case, it was the theft of car tyres.
Okay, as long as it's not animals.
No, we're not setting fire to animals.
Okay.
Or burying cats in the garden. And he was first arrested for trying to steal from cars. Then he was arrested for stealing tyres. And then, perhaps most intriguing of all, he was discovered carrying a hammer, which the police at the time charged him with going prepared for stealing. I think it was far darker than that, as will emerge. But what you have is this... It's too easy to call Sutcliffe a loner. It's better to call him isolated. In 1969, he commits what were the first of a number of attacks on women. It's important to go into the genesis of Sutcliffe's dislike for women and particularly prostitutes. He found, as I've been saying, relationships with women complicated. And he started to resort to the streetwalkers of Yorkshire, West Yorkshire, Leeds, Bradford. And in 1969, he attacked one with a rock in a sock. And hit her because he was, and this is going to sound bizarre, and forgive me, he was convinced that he'd been rooked out of £5 by another prostitute whom he was searching for.
Sex worker.
Sorry, sex worker. I will use the word sex worker from now on.
Okay.
In this particular sex worker who was attacked, I could identify him. I mean, that's the bloke who did it.
Yeah.
And the police visited him and said, did you attack this sex worker? And he said, yes. And they said, well, you're a very lucky man because she doesn't want to press charges. Many people have speculated that this was the genesis of his, what could only be described as disgust with sex workers. And as many people pointed out in retrospect about the case, many, although by no means all, his victims were in fact sex workers, and they were what I suppose one would call the toughest of them all. They worked the streets. They didn't work. Many of them didn't work from a room or didn't have a maid. They just worked the streets. They got into cars, and that was it. But I think it's very telling that on one particular occasion, for example, one of the women who, you know, he thought had rooked him out of £5 because he'd paid, given her £10 and said, you owe me £5, had run off. And then he found her in a pub in the red light district and asked for his £5 back, and she made a joke of it and started, you know, sending him up in front of the customers, which made him very, very angry. Now, I'm not saying in itself that's enough to explain what became an absolute terrorising spree of killing sex workers, but it's an element in the structure of Peter Sutcliffe's character. Anyway, 1974, on Sonia's birthday, 24th birthday, Peter Sutcliffe marries Sonia, and she becomes Sonia Sutcliffe. They first of all live with her parents, and then eventually, with their mother's help, they buy a house, which was to become very famous. Not quite as famous as 25 Cromwell Street, but certainly close. Now, the period between 1969 and 1975, when there were no reported Ripper killings, Yorkshire Ripper killings, it's been speculated repeatedly that Sutcliffe was actually attacking women, although probably not killing them. There was a culture of not wishing to go to the police, not wanting to get involved. It's not surprising that sex workers were on the fringe of the law, and that was partly their lot.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, haven't we?
We have, and that's why, of course, as we all know, sex workers are often, unfortunately, prime targets for men who are or become serial killers, because they're such a transient population.
Like the homeless have that, what happens to the
yes.
homeless also.
Yeah. You know, the wonderful Gordon Byrne, my old friend and now sadly dead, wrote a wonderful book about this case called Somebody's Husband, Somebody's Son. And
why wasn't it called Somebody's Daughter, Somebody's Wife?
Good question. I'm afraid you can't take it up with Gordon.
Yeah.
There is something in Sutcliffe that provoked this detestation of women. And yet, in 1974, he marries Sonia. And eventually, they move into what she was later to describe as her dream house, of which there are many famous pictures. It was at number 6, Garden Lane, Heaton, in Bradford. It was detached, and it had a garage.
Oh, Jeffrey showed me a picture. Wow, that is smart.
Yes. And to believe it or not, Sutcliffe was quite hardworking. I mean, he had all sorts of different jobs. But in the end, he ended up a truck driver and employee of the year. I mean, cab was spotless. He didn't have any porn. Everything was tidy, you know. He was kind of meek and mild. Yeah,
employee of the year because he had no porn in his cab. Yeah, well,
some of the other truck drivers certainly did. But and now begins what can only be described as the complication of the case. We don't know for sure what happened between 1969 and 1975. Many people, and they include Michael Bilton, who wrote the best book, I think, on the Ripper, which is called Wicked Beyond Belief, insists that there were many more attacks in that period. But it wasn't until 1975... that we can begin to outline the attacks that we know about. And this is before the first killing. In July 75 in Keighley, he attacked a woman walking home. No more than that. This one was not a sex worker. He hit her over the head with a ball pin hammer and slashed her stomach with a sharpened knife. One of his signatures in the attacks was always to pull his victim's clothing up and slash the stomach. On the 15th of August in Halifax, he engaged a woman called Olive Smelt in conversation and then hit her with a hammer and again left her alive. On the 27th of August in 1975, he attacked his youngest victim, 14-year-old Tracy Brown, leaving her with, I'm afraid, dreadful brain damage, which required reconstructive surgery, and she was really never the same, and he ran off. Now, the first two attacks, there were quite consistent descriptions of the man. Descriptions of the goatee, description of the pale complexion, description of the accent. But it didn't really hit home until the first killing, which is on the 30th of October 1975, a woman called Wilma McCann, who was 28, and she certainly was not a sex worker. She was a mother of four. He hit her on the head, again with a hammer first, and then stabbed her 15 times in the neck, chest and abdomen, and mutilated her. In the wake of his death recently, her son very movingly described the fact that he wanted an apology from the West Yorkshire Police for describing his mother as any kind of sex worker, which she most certainly was not. And indeed, he got her an apology. But it fits in very much with this thing we've seen before. We're talking about the mid-70s. We're talking about a time in which police attitudes were not exactly pro-women. Mm. Particularly weren't particularly interested in sex workers. Well, yes, we'll try and keep them at bay, but they're not going to pay. It's a very male force, West Yorkshire, full of male attitudes. West Yorkshire Police obviously investigated, and they were thorough. If a little, how can one put it politely, if a little dismissive, Wilma McCann was 28. Sutcliffe said, finally, about that first attack, after that first time, I developed and played up a hatred for prostitutes. Forgive me, I'm quoting Sutcliffe here. Mm-hmm. In order to justify within myself a reason why I attacked and killed her. She wasn't actually a sex worker at all. However, not that long afterwards, in the very beginning of January 1976, Sutcliffe struck again. He killed a sex worker, Emily Jackson. She was using her husband's van as a way of entertaining clients. He took her to a derelict building in the van and hit her on the head with a hammer and again stabbed her with a sharpened Phillips screwdriver in the neck, chest and abdomen. That's the second killing. Well, inevitably, there are reverberations in West Yorkshire Police. And in May, he attacks again, this time a young woman called Marcella Claxton in Leeds. He hit her with a hammer, but this time left her alive. And she again gave really an immaculate description.
Because he never wears a...
No, doesn't wear a balaclava, anything, yeah. Doesn't wear a bandana, doesn't, you know, And indeed, he never changes his appearance. I mean, it's extraordinary. Mm. He never shaved his moustache off. He never shaved his beard off. Never wore disguises. Mm. He just went about his business, so to speak, in a rather chilling way of putting it. But there again, you now have three women, the first early attacks in 75, and then an attack in May 76, who have got a really clear view of the man who attacked them. Photo fits, but now we get into what can only be described as the chaos of the inquiry. It defies belief. If you go back and read about the inquiry, your mind starts to glaze over because it was so incredibly complicated. They didn't have a computer system. Everything was on index cards. All the index cards, there were so many thousands of the index cards. Cards were getting lost. The photo fits weren't matched together. They didn't always know that that was it. We can now look back in hindsight and say, well, look at the opportunities that were missed. Mm. We've already talked about one, you know, the photo fits and the descriptions. But there are going to be, in this extraordinary story, a lot more. There is now, clearly, what looks like a serial killer at loose. And bear in mind, this is less than a year after the Black Panther, Dennis Nielsen, a case we've done, mm-hmm. who got away with three murders, and then, of course, the terrible death of Leslie Whittle, whom he left in that drain, and who actually died from hanging. And that had caused a stir. You know, Nielsen got away with it, really, until that last moment, really. And there was a lot of uncertainty about how you deal with this. Is this really a serial killer? Is it what's going on? And you also have the added complication at this point, the police forces in that part of the north of England were all amalgamating. There was going to be, so you were getting one lot of bobbies mixing with another lot, and also higher up the hierarchy. And in particular, the senior detective, who was the assistant chief constable crime, a man called George Oldfield, was very defensive of his turf, and he was going to find this killer. Well, things went quiet until the 5th of February 1977, when a young woman, 28, called Irene Richardson, was killed. She was a sex worker, attacked in Roundhay Park in the Chapeltown area of Leeds. He'd offered her a lift. And cars become important in this story at this point, because he had one car with one set of tyres, and there are tyre marks in a number of these settings. It gets worse. You know, they take the tyre, they say, oh, they identify the treads. It's an XYZ, you know. In fact, at that point, I think it was a white Ford Corsair, which don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And he'd offered her a lift, and she said she wanted to pee. So she got out of the car, and he hit her over the head as she crouched down. And he tore open her blouse and mutilated her body. Not long afterwards, on the 23rd of April, he killed another sex worker in Bradford, but this time in her flat. She was called Patricia, always known as Tina Atkinson. She was 32. And she'd actually, one of the few victims who actually had a room of her own. And he killed her in the room. He'd been drinking in a nearby pub before travelling in his car to her flat. And he stabbed the mother of three multiple times in the stomach, covering her body with bed linen and leaving behind a boot print on a blood-stained sheet. They were quite interesting boot prints, actually. They were work boots. distinctive. And there'd been a work brute prince, one of the earlier victims.
These attacks weren't sexually motivated.
Well, I think it's what a very good point. No, they weren't. Very few of these victims had sex with Sutcliffe. Sutcliffe was killing, but it wasn't, obviously, motivated by sexual rage.
Mm.
He had a thing, and that's the only way of putting it, about sex workers. But not all the victims were sex workers, as I've taken some care to say. In June 1977, he killed Jane McDonald, who was 16, certainly not a sex worker, and became the first of what were later known to the police as the innocent victims, which I think says a lot about their attitude to sex workers.
That's awful.
She clearly was a perfectly innocent, upright young woman. And interestingly, many years later, after Sutcliffe is finally caught, she is the only victim he has any remorse over. He describes all the others as filth. I was cleaning up the streets. I know that sounds hard to believe, but that is actually what he said. In part two, I'll read a little bit of the confession. Anyway, time being what it is, I'd better press on with this fairly unpleasant litany. But this case that always sticks in my mind. There was another attack in July 1977, but he didn't kill her because he was interrupted. And his car was seen by a witness. Again, there were a whole series of leads that were not effectively followed up. Nowadays, that wouldn't happen. We got big computer systems. We got the home office computer for major inquiries. But we are talking about a different age of policing. We're talking about bobbies on the beat. We're talking about senior officers who basically were good, honest workmen. And the hardest person, as we know only too well, Mo, to catch is a random serial killer, because there's no link to the victims.
Mm.
It's just out there. And so this becomes a very, very complicated case. But, and I think this is the case that always sticks in my mind, it's the sixth killing. On the 1st of October 1977, Sutcliffe killed a sex worker from Manchester called Jean Jordan. Now, this is out of his comfort zone. Manchester's not immediately in the area. It's the first time out of the comfort zone. I'm just digging up this rather helpful map that I was going to show Mo that illustrates the area. This is the first time he's in Manchester.
Okay.
And now bear in mind he lives in Bradford.
Oh, yeah, it's quite far.
Yeah, it's a good drive.
I'll put a picture of it on the Instagram.
Anyway, he kills her in Manchester and then dumps her, covers her up. But he's paid her with money straight out of his pay packet from the truck driving job. In other words, it's a new £5 note. 8 days later, when they're having a moving in party to the house in Garden Lane in Bradford, and all sorts of people are invited, Sonia and he are entertaining, after the party, Sutcliffe gets into his car and drives back to Manchester, where he finds the body, which is hidden, and searches desperately for the £5 note. Because, of course, he's now convinced that the police will be able to trace him from the £5 note.
I can't believe he's worried about that after all the other clues he's left behind.
He actually, it was a very nasty attack. I mean, he just about sawed her head off. He used a hacksaw. A very unpleasant attack. But that was post-mortem too. 8 days later. But of course, Sutcliffe is well aware that he has a perfect alibi. he was having a housewarming party, and he was driving his guests home. The fact that it took him a very long time to drive his guests home is by the by. He knew he had an alibi, so, well, it'll be all right, won't it? I think if there was a turning point in Sutcliffe, that was probably it. Gene Jordan, you know, he was interviewed in the wake of the £5 note at his firm. In fact, he was interviewed twice. Because, believe it or not, the good Gene Jordan had put the £5 note in a secret compartment in her handbag, which Sutcliffe didn't find. And when her body was eventually discovered, the police did find the £5 note. Now, you have two lines of inquiry. You have the description of the car inquiry, right? What the car he was picking up sex workers in was like.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the £5 note inquiry. Now, the police set out, first of all, to try and track the cars. But it's a mammoth task because they haven't got an exact description of it. And then they, of course, set out to track the £5 note. They go to the Bank of England, seek out the number, where that was sent to. It was delivered in a group of £25,000 to a bank in Shipley, not far from Leeds. And the number of people who came in to collect the money, they traced it. And one of the people they traced it to was the truck driving firm which employed Peter William Sutcliffe. And Sutcliffe appears on a list of potential suspects, but it's no more than that. And besides, when they interview him, well, when they interview Sonia and he about the killing of Gene Jordan in Manchester, they both say, no, he was here, you know. And I'm not suggesting for one moment that Sonia knew what was going on. I'm simply saying that as far as she was concerned, it was perfectly...
He'd been at the party.
Yeah. The seventh killing, and I will not go on with this litany because it does become pretty awful after a while, came in January 1978 when a 21-year-old called Yvonne Pearson from Bradford was again bludgeoned with a hammer. But this time, the ignominy goes even further. He dumps her body under an old sofa and stuffs her mouth full of horsehair from that's inside the sofa. He's a man out of control. 10 days later, he kills an 18-year-old called Helen Ritka, who is actually a sex worker from Huddersfield. He hit her over the head 5 times and then stripped off most of her clothing and stabbed her repeatedly. At this point, Sutcliffe said, and I'll come to it in part two, "I had the urge to kill any woman. The urge inside me to kill girls was now practically uncontrollable." In 1979, in April, he killed, again, a girl called Josephine Whittaker. And I missed one. In the 16th of May, 1978, he killed Vera Millwood in the car park of Manchester Royal Infirmary. He hit her with a hammer before stabbing her again. Again, I'm afraid she was a sex worker. She was very frail and she only had one lung. A man heard screams from the hospital grounds, which he assumed had come from a patient. Then in 1979, in April, he kills a woman, young woman called Josephine Whittaker. This is the 10th killing. The inquiry into the cars just grinds to a halt because there are simply too many and there are too many sightings and nobody knows. The inquiry into the £5 note grinds to a halt, again, because there's nothing. The card indexes are so extraordinarily random that actions are not always followed through. George Oldfield, the man in charge of the inquiry, has devoted himself now to finding the man who is by this time named by the press as the Yorkshire Ripper. He's killing women in the streets, on the streets. But then comes the, I suppose in this way, the coup de grace of this particular part. Oldfield is sent a letter by a man calling himself Jack the Ripper and saying, "You haven't caught me yet." And what's more, he sends him a tape with his voice on it. Always known, forever known as the Wearside Jack tape. Oldfield becomes convinced that this is actually the killer, even though there's no evidence. A lot of people were telling him it's a hoax. No, he's convinced. So anybody who spoke with a Yorkshire accent and not with a Sunderland accent, in other words, the northeast, Wearside, came mm-hmm. Dismissed from the inquiry.
Oh, God.
You know, well, there was no denying that Sutcliffe had a Yorkshire accent. Mm. You know, I mean, it's extraordinary, Wearside Jack. I mean, if you like, a link to Mindhunter, they contacted the nascent BAU about this tape, and the guys at the BAU said, "It's a hoax. What on earth are you listening to it for?" Oldfield dismissed it. Absolutely. Mm. No, absolute nonsense. This is the man. So he gets another police force. Now you've got police forces in Manchester, Leeds, Sunderland, all looking for Peter William Sutcliffe. How do they find him? Well, that comes in part two.
Cool. Thanks, Dad. Okay, that was part one of the Yorkshire Ripper. There's a lot of ground to cover.
Yes, this is really one of those.
This is meaty.
It's a big case.
Meaty, meaty. Well, Fabo, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Well, I don't know. Pleasure is perhaps not the right word, but it is. It's a very, very interesting case, but it can get to you, I'm afraid, because he was such a manipulator. And so blatant. I won't give away the ending because it's good in itself.
No, well, we'll hear it in part two.
But what's happening this week? It's your birthday.
It's my birthday. The day that you are listening to this podcast is my birthday day.
There you go.
It's my birthday.
It's lovely.
I love my birthday. I love birthdays generally.
Yeah. I'm not asking how old you are. No, I'm not.
I'm older than I want to be.
I'm older than I want to be, but so now I can't get away with it.
Yeah, so there you go. So, yeah, it's my birthday.
Yeah. And you got a new coat. Very good.
I got a new coat. I got some new trainers.
Wonderful.
Jeffrey and I are wearing matching trainers today.
Yep, except mine are white and Mo's black.
Yeah. We'll try and take a picture of them.
Well, we should.
I was meant to get dressed up, but I didn't get dressed up. Feel bad about it now.
No, don't feel bad about it.
I just decided I wanted to be comfy.
Good. Well, actually, I am comfy, and even if I've dressed up.
Well, there you go.
I'm wearing cufflinks, which is a rare event.
Jeffrey looks very chic today. He's wearing a dress shirt. I will send pictures. I will post pictures. Anyway, we better go because we've waffled on. Not waffled. That's no. Rude.
We ought to say thanks.
Yes. So thank you so much to all the people that help us. Our producer, Sam Brain, who makes it possible. My brother, Dan, who did the music. My friend, George, who drew our caricature. To Audio Boom for hosting us. To Jeffrey for giving up his week to this misery. Thank you. And to you, the listeners, without you. We basically, we'd just be talking into thin air.
Absolutely, we certainly are aware that we're not doing that. And of course, as always, I have to thank Mo, whose idea this was, and remind you that bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.